We could do a whole episode on why we hate critical fumbles.
We easily could.
5% of the time I slice off my own foot.
Why we hate critical fumbles, part one.
Live from the Mundangerous Snow Fort in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 28 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about first-time game masters, preparing for running your first game, and playing in a game with a new GM. But first, the Morning Glory campaign meets aggressive allies, and the Pike Fighter keeps enemies at arm's length in the Character Creation Forge.
So before we talk about that, Enemies Beyond got released for Warhammer 40K RPG.
Second edition Dark Heresy. It's the third
splat book.
Right.
And it's like a month after the last splat book came
out. I had no idea, and suddenly, here it is.
Yeah. They released one, and it had already announced the other one. It was amazing.
Yeah, when they say Q1 2016, they mean Q1 2016.
Yeah, you haven't had a chance to take a look yet, though, right?
No, I showed up last time at our Rogue Trader game that we're running with the DH2 system, and you were like, "Hey, yeah, the book," and I was like, "Well, you bought it already?"
Yeah,
yeah. But then we got to playing, and I didn't actually leave through it.
Well,
because we can't spend XP because we haven't got a chance to rest yet,
right? Because they're still in prison.
Thanks. Yeah,
that's true.
Well, no, we're on a prison ship now.
Well, it wouldn't be a prison ship if you would escape it. Then it would just be a space hole.
It would still be a prison ship. We just wouldn't be on it. It doesn't stop being a prison because you break out.
Oh, well, I figured you'd blow it out of the sky, and that would make it stop being a prison ship.
Yes, that's very true.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, so it's got a ton of high-level content. It's focused on the Ordo Malleus, which are the demon hunters of the Inquisition. And so it's all geared towards fighting super high-level demons.
It's really perfect for our actual Dark Heresy game. That Jim runs and Shane and I both play in. Yeah, we're basically demon hunters. Okay, we like to think of ourselves as demon hunters.
We're actually members of the Ordo Xenos. It's just that all of our adventures end in a demon.
I mean, as you do.
Yeah, so yeah. We're running, would be nice.
We're running published adventures, so...
Spoiler.
They all end in demons.
Yeah, it's true.
It
wouldn't be 40K if it didn't end up with a demon tearing through reality and blowing your mind.
Yeah, I feel like that's what people want. That's what I want.
Right.
Yeah.
So this one has a lot more player options, and it also has statted out high-level greater demons. So the Bloodthirster, the Great Unclean One, the Master of Change, I think, is Tzeentch, and whatever the Slaanesh one is. So it's got greater demons, threat level 100 on a scale of 0 to 100.
When we got wrecked by recently something that was 32, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. 22.
Oh, even better.
Yeah.
Perfect.
So we got some work to do in Dark Heresy. but I'm excited to get that one to the table. I mean, Ordo Xenos is immediately useful because we're playing Rogue Trader and that deals more with aliens. Mm-hmm. But I think this is going to be a great supplement for an actual Dark Heresy campaign.
I mean, the great thing about the longevity of 40K games is no upper limit. You just keep gaining XP.
Yep. And you're still never going to feel comfortable.
Right. We've got like 6,000 or 7,000 XP in the actual Dark Heresy
game.
And
we still all have our character planned for another like 4,000 XP because you never feel safe. So how about Morning Glory?
Well, when last we talked, the Mass Disjunction had destroyed Metrol and wiped all the party's magic items.
Nice.
Yeah, you're welcome. And then Primus shows back up and says, "You're no good to me here. I need you to help me fight the fiendish overlord Raltul Kesh, the Rage of War." And so he just turns the entire party into a bunch of monsters with all new character sheets.
Implying that we weren't monsters already.
Now the outsides match the insides.
Right.
You approach the epicenter of the carnage, defeat 2 Baelors, 2 Pit Fiends, a Planetar, and you halt the Overlord's transformation, his apotheosis and sort of return. and then Primus appears again, heals all of you, and assists you in attacking Raotul Kesh. Of course, at this point, the party's sort of wondering about the endgame, because Primus is attacking, you're attacking, but, you know, Primus is basically on par with a single overlord, so he has time to talk, and you're asking questions.
Yeah.
It's the exposition scene in the right. middle of combat. And Primus explains that if he kills Raotul Kesh here, it'll taint the entire countryside for hundreds of miles around you.
Which Brand was okay with.
Yes. At this point, many of the rest of the party were saying, oh, this is how the Mornland happens.
Yep. We were wrong. That's not what happened.
And it wasn't so much that they were like, oh, no big deal. It was, oh, this happens because it already happened. Like, now we're finding out. And of course, it's better to create the Mornland than to like let a fiendish overlord run free on the face of Eberron. Yeah,
particularly the rage of war.
Right. So, you know, greater good, lesser evil, whichever, you know?
Right, right.
Primus also explains that he's preventing Raotul Kesh from just simply teleporting away. But at the same time, Raotul Kesh is sort of doing the same thing. So they're sort of locked together in this, you know, teleport lock.
Yeah, so what we should do is stab them with a sword, mm-hmm. bind ourselves into a kyber shard, bury ourselves in the ground, and mm-hmm. form a new religion.
You obviously should have, and that would have been awesome if one of you had done it, but you didn't think of it.
No, it's true.
You know, you really could have been that much closer to Subarus.
I could have, yeah.
So, of course, the party is coming to a consensus. You can't let an overlord escape, so you're basically trying to convince Primus to just kill Raotul Kesh, and, you know, a day of mourning is kind of the only option. And things get a little dicey because Primus says, no, I won't abandon Seer.
Which is garbage, by the way. He is a deific being from the plane of order, and yet he is willing to sacrifice, he's not willing to sacrifice one country in exchange. Like, he is the worst character to have sentiment like that.
That's what you were thinking too. Like, I don't understand this. This doesn't make any sense. But, you know, maybe Primus was just really good buddies with Aaron DeKenneth.
Yeah.
They're bros.
Yeah. He's not supposed to let that in. It's
maybe there are more.
You gotta remain pragmatic.
It's true.
But he didn't.
Or did he? Because suddenly the entire battle disappears. The corpses are gone. Primus is gone, Raotul Kesh is gone, the sky is gray, everything is quiet, you're standing next to the ruins of the library, but nothing's happening. And then in the distance, in the west, you see two creatures flying toward you. As they get closer, you're wondering, uh-oh, is this more devils, more demons, what's going on? And as it gets closer, you see feathers. And then you go, okay, that's also bad, right? Mind-controlled celestials.
We had just been fighting angels.
Right. But they land, they don't seem hostile, and they talk to you. They greet you cautiously and say, what are you doing here? You explain who you are, you give your names, and you say, we were just in Metrol. Are we still in Metrol? I'm confused. We were fighting Raotul Kesh. And as a show of good faith, the party says, oh, there's probably a released devil a little bit to the north. You should go find him.
And then I got sold out. Then the party tried to sell out Bran and say that he had bound him and made a contract with him. Which is true, but still not the way you want to lead off with it.
Yeah, you don't want to explain right off the bat, hey, by the way, he's our buddy. Guilt by association and all. So they escort the party about 2 miles to the west to a city that they say is called New Metrol. And then the party gets inside. There are thick stone walls. There are celestials all over the place, and then also humanoids, mostly humans. And you can see that they're wearing the garb of the Metrol City Guard. And then the city guard arrests you and charges you with the kidnapping of the entire nation of Seer.
And we'll find out what happens next week.
So, this week we're talking about first-time GMing. We've actually gotten a fair number of questions from listeners who have said that they either did GM their first game or that they're about to and they've got a few questions. So we thought we'd do an entire episode about it.
Yeah, and I think we are coming at this from the perspective of somebody who has played before, but perhaps not GM'd, versus somebody who's never played a role-playing game.
Yeah, I think it's pretty rare, or relatively rare, for a person who's just never even done it before to get into it, except in those rare instances when an entire group of people says, hey, let's try out D&D.
The starter box.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Or like how everyone I know started.
That's interesting, because I don't think I know anyone who didn't learn from someone else who had already knew how to play.
Nope, that's how I learned.
Wow.
Yeah. One of my buddies, his dad had the old Red Box, and so he knew what D&D was, but had never played. And I bought the AD&D Core Rules 2.0 CD-ROM after playing Baldur's Gate and Planescape. So, yeah, and the rule is when you have the books, you become the GM.
See, I was about to say, oh, wow, that's old school. And then you said CD-ROM.
Yeah, CD-ROM, yeah.
Which to me is not old school.
No, it's not old school at all. No, I bought it at the very tail end. In fact, the first game, the only game I actually ran was in third edition. I never ran a second edition game until much later and then realized I kind of like third edition better.
So your first time playing was your first time running?
Yeah.
Whew.
Yeah.
It's not a thing that I recommend.
Many TPKs later. Many rocks fall, you die. Like, I made every mistake as a first-time GM.
So if you've never played before, well, one, it's unlikely that you're listening to this podcast.
That's what I would
episode
say.
Episode 28, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You've probably tried your hand at it sometime before this.
Yeah, if you have never played a role-playing game and you're going to be a first-time GM, I would suggest listening to actual plays or watching like Acquisitions, Inc. or something like that, mm-hmm. where you can see experienced players playing so you get a feel for the table. And then come listen to this episode.
After listening to the first 27.
Also, yeah. Well, maybe listen to this episode and then listen, go back.
Just keep downloading them.
Just subscribe and move on.
All right, so for the rest of you who've actually played role-playing games but have not actually GM'd, it's a very different experience from playing the game.
Yeah, because instead of being responsible for one character, you are responsible for all of the non-player characters, as well as the fun of the players.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, babysitting all the players
yeah.
and their characters.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there's not a lot of downtime. You're always either responding to something that your players are doing, or you're instigating or provoking them to make things happen.
Right.
So there's more attention on you during the session, but there's also more pressure and there's more prep, usually.
Oh, yeah.
All right. It's interesting because you've had this from sort of both angles. Is GMing, is it more fun than playing?
It totally depends on the group and the players.
I totally agree.
Because I've had amazing games in which I was a player. Like Morning Glory has some of the best sessions that I've ever played in, right?
Sweet.
And then I also have games that I loved running it for groups that I like playing with. So it's a different kind of fun.
Yeah, and it depends on, you know, what you find fun. But of course, there's really only one way to figure that out.
Well, to me, and this is maybe a bit misleading because GMs don't actually do that much writing, but it's the difference between writing something and enjoying writing and reading something and enjoying that medium, right? Like, there's a different type of fun for creation than there is for consumption.
That's interesting. I liken the experience to reading something that I have written. Does that make sense?
Okay. After someone else has edited it severely.
Yes, after working with the horrible editor.
It almost seems like you write the first part of it and then let somebody else finish your story for you kind of mm-hmm. thing, right?
Right, and it spins out. Maybe the prep work ahead of time is the writing to me, mm-hmm. and then the actual running of the game feels more like the reading, but also that's probably because I don't run games when I'm not drinking.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
Although it took me a while to get to that point. Okay, so if you're on the fence about it, what are some reasons that you might actually want to run a game yourself?
I think everyone should try it because it changes your perspective. Once you've sat behind the GM screen, you can appreciate when things happen in a game, what it takes for your GM to bring them to life.
Yeah, I think it really does make you a better player if you've at least experienced it.
Absolutely. Because when you start pulling on ancillary plot threads, or you start murder hoboing or whatever it is, mm-hmm. you will have experienced that, and you will understand what that means to the GM who's put in the prep work and all those sorts of things. So I think you become a more conscious player of everybody else's fun as well.
Yeah. And you know, when you're deciding, hey, should I ask for this house rule for my snowflake character, you can this more easily determine if that's actually reasonable or if you're really just being a solipsist.
Yeah, and
you are being a solipsist, by the way.
You also won't mind as much when the GM just rolls his eyes, because you will probably have rolled your eyes at a player too.
Right. You're probably like, well, I mean, let's just see if this flies. No, that's cool. Yep. I wouldn't have done it either.
That's how it is with Cameron, right? He's always like, can I do this? And I'm like, no. He goes, fair. or Jim's like, I'll allow it.
Also, you might honestly find that you enjoy it more. You know, I actually took a long time before I decided to start trying my hand at GMing, because I was really content being a player. And, you know, I didn't want to pour a ton of time into it. I had a little bit of stage fright. I felt like I wouldn't do a good job of it. So, yeah, so for years, I just didn't get around to it. And then one day I was like, eh, I got a one shot in mind.
Yeah, for me, when I have something that I'm ready to GM, I enjoy GMing much more than I do playing, mm-hmm. but I don't always want to GM, right? So it's nice to rotate and give you a chance to relax and recuperate and find a new story that you want to tell, right? Or that you want to kick off.
Yeah, it's great to have multiple people who are capable of running games in a single group, so one person doesn't just burn out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know sort of old school groups, the way that it used to be is one person would run and they would just always run for like 17 years.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, if you're capable of doing that, I am extraordinarily impressed, because I ran Morning Glory for 3 years. But that wasn't even every week. You know, we would alternate arcs, 6 weeks on, 6 weeks off. And then the last 6 months I did every single week. And that was tough.
Yeah, your last 6 months were also difficult because we had a firm end date that we had to finish the campaign. Mm. So you had to move the story in a regimented way. Whereas I think if you're just going to GM every week, it's a little bit different. You can kind of let the story meander.
That's true.
Sort of like Rogue Trader, right? I'm in no hurry for you guys to escape.
As
long as you guys are having fun, I have no reason to force you to escape. As long as you keep the plot moving in some direction, I don't mind. Because mm-hmm. I don't have an end point, you know? But that's a little less relevant for first-time GMs.
Right. I also think GMing lets you exercise different creative abilities that you may not have thought of using before, or that you just may not have known that you had.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's the difference between being an actor and a director, right? It's and it's just a different kind of fun. It's you are getting so much of your enjoyment from the happiness of the players mm-hmm. and the exploits and the stories that they help you create.
Or the rage of the players.
Or the rage, yes. That's also sometimes the looks of sheer shock and disappointment right. are also fun.
So if you've decided that you want to run a game, you know, you're in a regular group, there's already a game happening every week. How do you decide, hey, this is the week that I'm going to start? Do you just butt in?
Sometimes you have to. In some groups, if there's a GM who runs every week, then you might have to talk to that person and say, hey, I have this idea, I want to do it. In other groups where it's usually rotating GMs, you know, over a longer period, wait until after a story arc has ended or a campaign actually finishes, right? And you're kind of in that in-between period where you don't know what you're going to do next. That's a great time to step in and run a one-shot or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think I would definitely say for your first time out, run a one-shot or something very short. Mm-hmm. And so if you are stepping in, if you're cutting in, you don't need to say, hey, I'm going to take over. You just say, hey, you know, the next time that like you're totally swamped at work and can't prep, or you're sick or something, or, you know, the next time you just want a break, let me step in for one session.
Yeah.
Just get my feet wet.
Mm-hmm.
And no one should have an issue with that. It's also often a good time to try a different system, especially one that the group isn't necessarily familiar with. I find that this can reduce the expectations at the table of how it quote-unquote should go. You know, because if you've got people who've been playing the same game system for years and years, and they've been playing together, then they know how it works. And, you know, you may know how it works as well, but it feels different and you remember or need to know different things on the other side of the screen. And so it can be nice if nobody really knows the system that well.
I would take the exact opposite. If your group knows how to play a game, I would play that game because your group will know it's your first time. So they'll take it easy on you and they can help you with the rules. Players are more likely to know how to play their characters. You don't need to know how to play every character. You just need to know how to play your NPCs. And especially if you have another GM at the table with you, the other GM, she can sit there and say, hey, actually the rule is here. Or you can say, I need some help with this. What should I do? You know, you've got something to bounce the idea off of. Whereas if it's a first time system, you've got to help all the players learn it. You're responsible for all the adjudication. No one can really help you with the rules effectively. I would rather play something that's familiar than something that's new.
I think if you're comfortable with improvisation, then you can run a system that nobody really knows, because no one's going to know if you're just sort of making up a rule and going with it.
Yeah, but how do you know if you're comfortable with improvisation until you've GM'd before?
Maybe you're
an improv actor. Yeah, okay. All right, fine. If you are a first-time GM / improv actor.
Which I think there are probably a lot of.
There are likely. There's a good overlap there. But there's your exception.
If you are playing a system that everybody knows really well and you are expecting that people are going to give you a lot of feedback, do it in a group that you know really well.
Yeah, definitely. Or if you don't know them, be upfront.
Right.
You don't have to try and be bigger than you are. Everyone's there to have fun.
Also, you're going to be terrible.
It's going to go so bad. It probably won't go that bad, but you're going to feel like it went bad.
I still feel terrible about the first game I ran. We'll get there later.
All right, so let's talk about how to plan your first session.
So we usually talk about how you should do less prep than you think you need. But I think for your very first session, you should do a fair amount of prep.
Yeah, I like to say plan big, play small. So the exercise of planning, you're going to definitely overplan, and you'll plan heavily in areas that don't get used, and you'll underplan in areas that your players focus on, and mm-hmm. you'll make mistakes, but you will learn so much from the process of thinking about it. It will make you a better GM over time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if that means for all of your major plot points, you have all of the background of the NPCs, you have all the background of the locations, you have everything fully statted, you're unlikely to use most of that stuff. Mm-hmm. But maybe it colors your responses to the players because you've thought about this before. You know that the bartender is secretly running a drug smuggling ring. And so when the players come in and ask about drugs, you already know, yes.
This already sounds like a great first session.
I'm thinking of Vampire for this one, not D&D. I don't know why. I wouldn't recommend Vampire as a first-time GM move either, but...
We're looking for Silly Root. Perhaps you've heard of it.
But the point is, if you've already thought about what's important to your NPCs and thought about their relationships and thought about the culture of their location and all these different things, right? That will just filter into the way you run the game without you really thinking about it. In the same way that you don't remember every fact from a history book, but you remember the general impression that you got from that period.
Also, like we mentioned in the Salvaging a Dead campaign episode, all of this prep work that you're doing, you can use it later. Maybe years later.
Like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I think your first time out is a really good time to run a published adventure.
Yeah, I agree, because it's going to give you the guidelines that you need to understand the system and the flow of the story, right? It'll help you think about how to prepare, and then you'll completely throw that out the window later.
Mm-hmm.
Like you won't prepare like a published adventure eventually.
Yeah, actually, I would say
don't think about sessions in terms of the gray box of reading this text, right? You don't gray text when you're actually preparing your own campaign. No one sits down and says, okay, I'm going to read this passage at this time for this session.
Mm-hmm.
But in a published adventure, it gives you blocks of text that you can just read aloud.
Because it needs to be one size fits all. when you're running a published adventure, don't get scared that, oh God, how do I prepare this much material for my own games in the future? You don't need to.
Right. They've done all that work for you so that when you read it, you'll remember some of it and then you can incorporate it into the session.
Right. And then when you make your own homebrew from scratch and don't use the published adventure at all, it's going to be so much less work and so much less complicated than a published adventure.
Yeah.
Nowhere near.
It's going to be like a few names and some arrows.
Right.
Like,
predetermined DCs.
Yeah.
That don't change. If you are running a published adventure, it can be helpful to read reviews of it online and some recaps, maybe even listen to a few actual plays to see how other people ran it, just so you're really familiar with it. But don't feel beholden to them. And this is usually the case with published adventures, but if you're running your own homebrew, keep it low to mid-level. Beginning characters maybe are a little too swingy and not quite as forgiving. You might accidentally kill people really easily. And of course, high level almost always has too many options.
Yeah, you end up with this problem of you don't know all of your players' abilities, so you don't know how to plan for them well, and then they either steamroll you or you crush them, and no one is happy with that.
Right. If you've spent, 6 months watching these characters gain these new abilities, kind of like along with the players as well, and dealt with in each session, oh, this new ability, you know how it works and you know how it interacts, that's how high-level play really starts to make sense and becomes more smooth. But if you're jumping right into it, it's really difficult even for seasoned GMs and seasoned players.
Oh yeah, I mean, I still couldn't tell you what every spell in the PHP does, how it works.
We do.
We know the names of the spells, and so we know roughly what they do just from past editions, but I couldn't actually tell you what the specific limitations of most spells are.
We do so much looking up for every character creation forge.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You're like, hold on, wait a second.
Yeah, my book is in tatters.
So I absolutely did this wrong my first time out. My very first game was a one-shot at 15th level in 3.5.
That was dumb.
That was the dumbest thing I've ever done.
Had your players played before?
Yes, they were actually seasoned players.
That was really dumb.
But no one had played at that high a level.
Oh.
We had gotten maybe to level 7.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, hey, I really want to see some high-level play. This will be awesome. Me being an idiot and not realizing 3.5 is the worst addition to try out high-level play.
Yeah, yeah. Because there were just hundreds of thousands of options and combinations.
It was crazy. It was supposed to be a one-shot, and I think it went 3 sessions before everyone was just like, I think we're good. Thanks for doing this.
Wow, they pulled you off stage, huh?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, we played in the basement of a comic book shop. And so, like, after a while, they just closed, So they're like, well, we got to wrap it up. Got to go home. Just tell us how it ends.
Oh, man.
Right. And part of it was just that the combats took forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, like you said, plan big, but play small. Plan out a few beats for this story that you're going to present. It's probably going to be a one-shot. So present a problem, present several options for solutions, introduce an obstacle or two, some more options for solutions, and then resolve that story. That's it.
Yeah, and depending on the experience level of your players, you might need to be more ham-fisted with the options you're presenting. Make one or two look very, very good, so that you've got an idea of the direction they're going, versus you can be very sandboxy, and I kind of hate that word, but you can be very open-ended with your problem solving if you're comfortable. Like, for example, I had no idea how you were going to escape from your prison in Rogue Trader.
Mm-hmm. Neither did we.
Yeah. I let you guys figure that out. I figured you guys are good enough players. You know the system well enough. You'll figure something out. All I have to do is set some parameters. Whereas in a first-time GM or that sort of situation, I would want to have two clear ideas in mind for, okay, you could bribe the guard or you could secretly steal lockpicks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Those are two options, and I will push you towards one or the other. I will make the guard look very shady. I will make him complain about money. I will make him complain about his bosses in front of you. Or I will put one of you in the mechanical shed, or wherever you hide the... I don't even know what the parts of lockpicks are. You'll be in the hairdresser's studio. I don't know. Bobby pins? Whatever, right? Make it just very clear. Pick whichever you think is best, but here are two good options. You don't have to think past that.
Yeah, you really want it to be more like a choose your own adventure story.
Kind of, yeah.
As opposed to an MMO RPG.
Yeah. And then when your players push against those rails, just move stuff in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, no, we don't want to do either of that. We're going to try and pickpocket the keys. All right, fine. They're pickpocketing from the guard who's not very loyal to his boss. He is the most careless.
Yep.
You're still following your story from there.
That's right. And one of the nice things about having two very simple options is if they do sort of go off the rails a little bit after they've already chosen one, you have this other unchosen option that you can just sub in somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't go to the forest. Well, okay, if they get lost later or they decide to go off the path later on, guess what? They show up in that first encounter that you had prepared for eventually anyway.
Yeah, that's how to use combat encounters,
mm-hmm,
or traps. You just move them wherever they're walking. There happens to be something in front of them.
You know?
It doesn't matter whether you go east or west. Whichever way you go, that's where they are.
And since we suggest don't use very many battle maps, if any, or too many props your first time out. So you don't need to move this map of this forest that you made. It's just a description you have jotted down on a piece of paper.
Yeah, this is a good time for the dry erase combat map. Just draw it on in the moment, you know? Maybe have an idea. Maybe pre-draw it on your notes, but don't actually commit it to a map until you're fighting there.
That's way too much work. And then ahead of time also, I don't usually do this anymore, but your first time out, I would print or bookmark your monster entries. Any monster that you think you might potentially be using, so you don't have to flip back and forth. It's just sort of nice to have them right there. And then you can jot down HP right on the piece of paper that you printed out.
Yeah, I still try and do that, actually, just because it makes that much faster for combat.
Mm-hmm. And then ahead of time, I would keep house rules to a minimum. Lots of times you'll have players come to you and say, hey, can I try out this? We're going to do this. Unless it's already an established house rule that your group uses, I would just say, maybe in the future, but I'm going to stick with the book for my first time.
Yeah, if your group always has critical fumbles on rolling a one, then fine, keep critical fumbles.
Except don't keep critical fumbles.
Or keep your house rules to restricting options for the players so that you're narrowing the rule set, not expanding it.
Right. So what happens when you've done all this prep and you're actually in the middle of it? You're running your first session.
Well, you want to start with an introduction. You want to set the scene. Where are you and who are you?
Mm-hmm. And just allow some time for introductions and role-playing. This is one of those few rare times where the GM doesn't need to do a whole lot. You just sort of sit back and let people create a bunch of hooks for you.
Well, sometimes you want to go ahead and have some questions to kind of prompt them, right? Mm-hmm. What does your character look like? Usually you ask, what's your backstory? And that's actually the wrong question because that's usually useless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's questions like, why are you here right now with these adventurers? Those are like, they're things that play into the exact scenario you're in versus this ethereal idea of who your character was.
Right. You'll need to do less of this with an experience group, but it usually is good to have one or two questions like that, sort of existential questions almost, that really help people figure out what is the direction of this story.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question, since this is the first time we've talked about the characters.
Mm-hmm.
Pre-gens or let them roll their own? If it's a one-shot.
I would go back and listen to episode 21, one-shots. Because it's good either way. I would say if it's a published adventure that comes with pregens, sure, why not? But really, I think it's group choice. Do they want to run with pregens? I don't think it's any more difficult to GM for pregens than it is for characters that people actually create themselves, especially if you're doing low to mid levels. It's usually hard to break things that early.
The only thing I would add to that, I would advise if you're going to let your players roll their own characters, do that separately from your first session.
Mm.
Do a session zero, do character creation offline, something like that, to where you know what the characters are before you show up.
Yeah.
Because if you try and kick off your first campaign and you have no idea what the characters are playing, you're going to be in for some... there's always going to be something you didn't anticipate, right? And that might ruin your confidence early.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Players and you should be aware of the characters ahead of time, even with pre-gens, because you don't want people showing up and then you hand out sheets and then now everyone's trying to figure out who am I and why am I here and what are my abilities?
Yeah, I would do the same thing. I would actually send out the pre-gens like a week beforehand and let everybody kind of look at them and choose, oh, that sounds most interesting to me.
Right. So I think either way, whatever you decide, just do it ahead of time.
Yeah. So we've done some introductions. We've maybe gotten some light role playing. We've learned why the dwarf and the elf are in the same party.
Because they always get along. They're great friends.
Oh. Mm-hmm. And are you homebrewing again?
Always.
Then you need to kick off the story, right? Mm-hmm. We've met the characters. Now let's get some inciting action.
Yeah, everybody's waiting for this at this point. What are we here to do? What is the obstacle we're here to overcome? So introduce that objective. I think some first-time GMs feel a need to be adversarial with their party, and that is either in role-playing, you know, they don't want people to get too far off the rails or do things that they weren't prepared for, or in combat, they feel like they really need to present a challenge or they're out to kill the players. Sorry, kill the characters.
Don't kill your players. Don't kill players.
But it's not necessary for people to have fun. And actually, I would say it probably prevents people from having fun in general.
Mm-hmm. And eventually, you're going to get to combat.
Yeah. You've probably been waiting for this. You've probably been prepping for it for a while.
That's probably where you spent most of your time, is that combat that's just going to make your players realize, this is what I've been missing the whole time. This epic combat.
I'm going to show them the way it's supposed to be done.
Right. This is the best gladiatorial arena fight ever.
I repurposed my Super Bowl snack stadium for this. Prepare for the guac pits.
Don't do that.
Don't do that.
Don't make it a huge set piece. Get used to running multiple characters in combat. Get used to managing initiative. Get used to adjudicating effects. Get used to reacting to all of the things that your players have on their character sheets with a nice low-level skirmish.
Yep. You just know? Test those waters.
Yeah, yeah. If nothing else, I would say you want to give at least one round to each character. Right. If it ends after everyone has acted at least once, I'd say that's a good barometer. System dependent, of course. Some systems you just can't end that quickly. Fourth edition.
And some systems, if it went an entire round and everyone used up all their actions, it went on way too long.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm looking at you, Eclipse Phase and Shadowrun.
Right. But in general, you kind of want to get everybody a chance to go through their character sheet, make a tactical decision, sort of get through the initiative order, and then go back to your story.
Yeah, because in general, across almost all RPGs, combat takes much longer than you think it's going to take.
It's the only hobby where a 5-minute fight takes an hour, and an hour walk takes 5 seconds.
And of course, you can't get that time back. You know, if you take too long on the combat, that really bogs down the story. If the combat ends up being too short, great. You can throw another enemy in, or you can just have another one later. It's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of those tasks that you're not used to doing in combat, delegate them to have the other players help you out. You know, have someone else track initiative. Make sure that someone is writing down the inventory. Point at someone and have them look up a rule if you don't know what it is. But of course, if you don't know and it's taking a while and no one knows it off the top of their head, just make it up. Move on, and then have someone look it up later.
Yeah, I would also say that it can help if you have somebody else managing the minis.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times if you say, okay, move that guy here, right? So it's just one less thing you can do, and you can kind of stay focused.
I'll also say it's a good habit to start developing, because as a GM, sometimes you get in this role where you're the one who sort of does everything. You know, you write everything down, you hand everything out, you move everything on the table, and then everyone keeps adopting that, and then it's just way too much work for you. You want to train your players early.
Yep, yep. And this is one of the hardest ones for a GM. You can't really participate and get distracted in all the table talk.
It's just as hard for accomplished GMs as well.
Yeah, I mean, and I do this all the time. I get caught into our whimsical discussions of lore and different things, but you are ultimately the one responsible for the clock. So you've got to keep the story moving. You've got to get to the point where your adventure ends. So you can't get sucked into that. And you don't want an hour of your session to be lost because you got into a debate about why Bantha milk is blue.
When it's obviously green. Hello.
That's not canon.
But it is always homebrew.
Wait, also always don't homebrew. Let your podcast get distracted by these discussions either.
Right. Oh, man. So think about it. When is it that you usually have time to engage in table talk? It's when it's not your turn or when someone else is having a discussion with the GM on the finer points of whether their mechadendrite fits into this particular slot.
Right, but you're the GM, so yeah. You have to have those conversations all the time.
You're having every single one of them.
Right.
It's really rare when you don't need to, and actually, I call it an advanced technique, is when you can have the party talking amongst themselves and planning something, and then you can just sit back and like rest for a little bit.
Yeah, if you can trick the players into talking in character for a while.
Right. It's always great.
You can like go get a drink.
It's right, great. Go to the bathroom.
Smoke break if you're lucky. All right, so you fumbled through your first session. It wasn't great, but it wasn't terrible. You're excited. You want to try it again. What should you do in the aftermath?
This can be a tough ask, but try to get feedback from your players.
Man, you'll never get honest feedback from your players.
But you'll get some honest feedback. Or sometimes someone will tell you what someone else said, and then a different person will tell you what that first person said, and you can just sort of add it all up.
Yeah. It is tough to tell somebody who's put themselves out there creatively that they didn't do a good job, mm-hmm. right? Everyone will be very complimentary, almost certainly, if they're normally adjusted human beings. You kind of have to drill down a little bit, right? Really ask them, okay, so this thing happened. How did you guys feel about that?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Kind of just the things that you were least confident in, ask how those went.
Yeah. And you don't necessarily need to press people to be like, tell me the thing that you hated.
Yeah.
You know?
Don't do that.
But, you know, you can usually infer from, okay, I got complimented on my combat. I got complimented on adjudication. But, no one really talked about characterization or my NPCs.
Yeah.
Nobody mentioned them.
Yeah.
Okay. That's fine. I'll work on that.
This is also a good time to review your notes and see what did you have that you didn't need and what were you missing that you wish you had, right? What were the things that came up at the table that you should have or could have prepared so that you can prepare better next time?
Mm-hmm. Remember earlier when we said you will overprepare in some areas and underprepare in others? This is where you figure out which was which.
Yeah, and after years, you will have learned it's best not to prepare because you will always do it wrong.
General outline. Really, every session is a variation on a theme.
Yeah.
I don't use recipes when I cook anymore. I just use the same ingredients, but in different amounts.
I just throw in more salt. Hides all my other mistakes.
You should also keep the notes that you wrote in case you want to run a future one-shot or you want to expand it into a larger setting or you want to use these NPCs somewhere else. Brazendel, the town that I keep in my back pocket for any time that I need a town, originally started as a one-shot and one of my very early ones.
Shameless plug, Brazendel will soon be appearing on the DM's Guild.
Keep an eye out for it.
We'll have an actual release date at some point in the future.
We'll let you know.
I'm working on the formatting now. So what if you're a player in a game where you know you have a new GM?
Well, remember all those times earlier in this episode when we said, it's going to be really tough. They're not going to be honest, or they'll be very brutal.
Or they'll fight against being put on the rails, or they won't pick up your hooks, or they'll try and derail your story, or they're murder hobos, like all those things that players do.
Don't do those things. Okay. Part of the fun of this hobby is that sometimes you do those things, but if you're dealing with a new GM, you know this is their first time out, don't do them.
Yeah, don't be a dick.
Yeah. We should do a whole episode on that.
That's Wheaton's rule. Yeah, be forgiving.
Mm-hmm.
You know a new GM is going to make mistakes. It happens to everybody. Everyone has been there. So when it happens, just accept it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not the end of the world, and it's going to be short anyway.
Right, it's one session. Yeah. So follow those hooks, even if you're sort of rolling your eyes and going, wow, this was really obvious. Yeah, it was really obvious. That's the point.
Yeah.
Because you're a moron and wouldn't have noticed it.
Right. So what if you put a flashing exclamation point over the NPC's head and said, quest given here? Just go ask the NPC about it. You don't have to dig around in the, all the other NPCs who don't have quests to give.
That's right. I'm going to go cut down every turnip stalk in the backyard looking for rupees. It's not that kind of game.
Speaking of... there's no artful segue for that. Just stay close to the rails. You know, new GMs are prone to railroading.
Mm-hmm.
Just accept it. Just don't fight against the railroads. See where the story goes.
Yeah, you don't have to stay on it the whole time, because you should push a little bit just so that they get some practice at dealing with unexpected circumstances. But don't try to walk out the fourth wall.
Yeah, and don't do that whole, oh, it's what my character would do thing. Because make a character that will stay near the rails.
Yeah.
This is not the cop who doesn't obey instructions. He's the by-the-book cop.
And if you're going to make corrections, offer them as gentle reminders, you know, hey, remember this is how grappling works. Of course you don't remember. Nobody really remembers. So let's go look it up. But again, do that gently. Keep the rules lawyering to a minimum. Just be nice about it.
Yeah, and if a ruling goes against you, suck it up and move on.
It's one shot.
Yeah. And I know we just said that players never do this, but players offer honest feedback after the game.
Mm-hmm.
Tell a GM, a new GM, what worked, and then tell them what didn't.
Yeah.
Because when you tell somebody their areas for improvement, it makes them believe the compliments that much more.
Mm-hmm. They want to get better. You want them to get better. You all want these games to be more fun. This will help.
Exactly. It grows the hobby. You need GMs to have role-playing games.
Mm-hmm. So water them, and not with tears. Maybe a few.
Do you hear that, Ishan?
Is that the sound of weeping GMs because they can't handle honest feedback?
No. That is the sound of the Character Creation Forge.
Oh, really?
Before we move on to the Character Creation Forge, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane, @MundDangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan, @EvilSansCarne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show, @TPTCast.
You can also email us if you can't fit it into 140 characters at totalpartythrill@gmail.com.
And last but not least, you can find us on the web at www.totalpartythrillcast.com.
So we promised you a pike fighter in the Character Creation Forge.
The Master Pikeman.
Or Pike Woman.
Fair enough. Not historically accurate, though.
Your history sucks. I would never want to play a historically accurate game.
No, Vikings were fine.
That's true.
Vikings had women in the front lines.
Yeah, yeah. But no tieflings. No winged tieflings. What's the point?
Okay, fair enough.
So, what does a pikeman do here? What's a pike? Okay. It's a big fish, right?
A pike is, it's in addition to being a big
it's
fish.
It's a road?
It can be, yes.
Okay.
It can also
I don't understand
be,
how this has anything to do with D&D.
Well, see, pikes were this weapon in the medieval era, which allowed a foot soldier with little training to hold their own against mounted knights who were nobles and had lots of combat training.
Did we make this just to ruin even more our mounted knight character?
It wasn't the original goal, but it was not lost upon me when I suggested it.
It's very Braveheart.
So, yeah, so the pike was something that you could brace against the ground and stab thrust into a horse and then dismount the knight.
That's terrible.
It's not great.
Yeah. Well, in D&D terms, a pike, a halberd, and a glaive are all basically the same weapon. They just do slightly different types of damage. Actually, no, the halberd and the glaive do the same slashing damage.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the only difference is basically no difference.
Well, there is one difference in the Polearm Master feat, which is that the pike doesn't get the full benefits of it, which is just a dumb oversight, and yeah, ignore that.
It has to be an oversight. It didn't get eroded, but it has to be an oversight.
Okay, so this build is clearly going to have Polearm Master because you kind of can't... There's no point wielding a polearm if you're not going to take Polearm Master, right? So why don't you explain what that feat is and then explain why it's dumb.
Polearm Master does a few cool things. It lets you, as a bonus action when you use the attack action, make an extra attack with the haft. So it does 1d4 damage plus all the other mods. It lets you make an opportunity attack when a creature enters your reach, in addition to when you could normally make an opportunity attack, which is when it leaves your reach.
Yeah. What's stupid about it is that first benefit, the bonus action attack. Mm-hmm. Does not apply to pikes, but it does apply to halberds,
glaives and quarterstaffs.
Right.
And then the second part
applies to pikes.
And glaives and quarterstaffs and halberds.
Yeah.
What?
No idea why.
It's because the pike is OP. Kills horses.
So the first tip to take away from this is that you should not be a pikeman. You should be a glaive or halberdman.
Right.
Or a woman. No historical context for that.
But of course, if your GM is reasonable, they will say, oh, right, of course it includes pikes. Not that it matters.
Yeah, and so the sort of trick of this is that you're triggering opportunity attacks more than your average character, right? Mm-hmm. And that's sort of where we went for this is he's sort of the reactive fighter, really. He's making attacks on off of his turn as often as he is on his turn.
Mm-hmm. But it really kind of turns out to be a one-trick pony because there are a lot of ways to get that bonus action attack. And once the first enemy realizes that if they get near you, they're going to get hit, no other enemies do. They just end up avoiding you. So it provides a decent amount of battlefield control, but without a way to lock down or without a way to get enemies to actually attack you, it's not really effective.
So we got to figure out how to get people to enter our reach. Or at least screw up while within our reach.
A couple of ways we decided to do this. The first was to be a glass cannon. If we decided to run heavily armored with a bunch of damage reduction and really high defenses, then the first enemy approaches you, gets knocked down, someone else tries to attack you and they miss or bounces off your armor or you shrug it off because it barely phases you with your massive amount of hit points. There is no reason that they're ever going to attack you. You are pointy and reactive and hard to hurt. They'll just go kill your allies.
Right. So we are looking for all of the ways that we can trigger opportunity attacks.
We also want to make those off-turn attacks count. So we're getting a lot of attacks. We're trying to figure out ways to make each of them hurt a lot.
So what's the build?
Swashbuckler 4.
But Ishin, you can't sneak attack with a pole arm.
That's correct. You can't. Which is really tragic because sneak attack is every turn and it would be lovely to have those dice on the off-turn attacks. Doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
Right. But Swashbuckler does let you move away from an enemy that you have hit with a melee attack without provoking opportunity attacks, which means
if they close in on you and attack you, you can then attack them, move so they are no longer in your reach, and then to attack you again, they will have to enter your reach, provoking another attack.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, sorry. So the build, Swashbuckler 4.
Champion Fighter 4. Paladin 12. So champion is there for really just the improved critical. You're making a bunch of attacks, so it's nice to just double your chances of being able to crit.
Right, and action surge and some of the, you know,
all the fighter goodies, and you get, you know, a quick ASI.
Right, right.
Paladin, though, well,
that's where you're going to make him count because paladin gets smite,
mm-hmm.
and paladin 12 will take you to improve smite, which gives you an extra d8 on every attack.
Mm-hmm.
Paladin also gets Compelled Duel. This is the Vengeance Paladin.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll get Compelled Duel and Hunter's Mark, which can both make your various attacks stick that much more.
Right.
And Compelled Duel can actually force creatures into your reach.
Right. And anytime you want to, you just pop off all of those smites. You can smite multiple times in a round. Multiple times in a turn and multiple times in a round.
Yeah, once per attack.
Mm-hmm. One of the problems with opportunity attacks in general is that they don't typically do a bunch of damage because they're just sort of this regular attack. And so, oh, yay, you know, a guy ran by you, you did 14 damage to it and no big deal.
Okay, fourth level smite.
Yep.
48 more damage. That's 4d8 right. more damage.
But you do have a 10% chance of critting.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's the other trick is... Even though you apply your smite after you hit, you always want to apply a smite on a critical because mm-hmm. that damage is also doubled.
Right. So it seems like we kind of went out of our way to get a bunch of ability score increases. Why is that?
Because we need so many feats.
So many ridiculous number of feats.
You're going to want Polearm Master for starters.
Mm-hmm. You're going to need Polearm Master.
Right. You'll also want Sentinel.
Mm-hmm.
Because that allows you to make an opportunity attack when an enemy attacks an ally in your reach.
And you got a lot of reach.
You do.
And when you do hit with an opportunity attack, for whatever reason, including from Polearm Master, you reduce their speed to zero. So they can't get away from you.
Right.
Or they can't go after your allies. And if you can figure out a way to prone, or an ally can prone, they also can't stand up.
Well, you've got that bonus action attack coming off your haft.
You could shove.
You could shove.
Or you've got two base attacks. You could shove and attack. Yeah, there are options.
There's ways to knock them down.
Mm-hmm. And then later, you're going to want Great Weapon Master. Because that allows you to take a -5 to your attack on any melee attack you're making and do an extra 10 damage.
Yeah, that is one of the most controversial feats, I think. Because people think the expected damage at low levels isn't that great. And it's very swingy, right? It makes it really hard to hit, and then you're not really getting that big of a return for it. That's why we like it as a later level feat.
Mm-hmm.
When you've got huge to hit bonuses and ACs cap out around like 24. Mm-hmm. So you can maintain pretty good odds of hitting at high levels, even taking a -5 with no trouble. And hey, 10 damage is 10 damage.
Right. And if you ever find yourself with advantage, just use it.
Yeah, definitely.
Pretty much any time, just use it.
Yeah, whenever you have advantage, use Great Weapon Fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Or Great Weapon Master, rather.
So what kind of a person says, the way that I shall worship my God in truth and justice is by taking up the pike?
So I think my Polearm Master is a commoner. He was drafted into the militia. He was forced to serve in his lord's army. And from that experience, they stuck a pike in his hands and he went to war. And when he came back, as you do when you're a 16 or 17 year old kid and you've seen a glimpse of the world, you can't go back to your parents' farm anymore. This is too boring for you.
Mm.
You've gotten the taste for adventure. You've gotten wanderlust now. You have to know what else is out there. You need more excitement. So that crusade or whatever it was that your lord led you on has now planted the seed, and you're going to strike out on your own, find your own fortune.
Yeah, the pike is a peasant's weapon. And so, of course, that my character also begins as a peasant on a farm near the wilderness where he often needs to defend their flocks and their herds from the encroaching darkness.
Oh, okay.
But the darkness isn't just natural. It turns out that there are orcs and fell beasts. And he starts off, I think, with a quarterstaff. You know, it's just a shepherd's crook.
Okay.
Learns to use that. And then realizes maybe if it were sharper.
Maybe if I put a sword on the end of this.
Right, that would help. And so goes to the blacksmith and says, I got an idea. And the blacksmith says, you're looking for a pike.
Yeah. I got to be honest. I thought you were going to take that in a different direction.
Really?
Yeah. I thought you were going to take it as it's the peasant's weapon. So you'll become a gorilla and fight against the nobility as you attempt to overthrow.
I like that idea. Robin Hood with a pike.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So you are expertly equipped to basically kill knights. Right?
I think it works well for a Little John as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, I could totally see this as a Little John.
Yeah.
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 But anyway, on the dark frontier, he also finds God.
Okay.
And then learns how do you destroy the encroaching darkness with searing light.
Right, right. Which deity do you think our paladin worships?
Ooh, that's a good question. I like goddesses of the wilderness, Myleki, or agriculture, Shantae, or just justice. Torm.
Yeah, I like justice.
Mm-hmm.
I think especially if you're playing the gorilla fighting against the whole feudal system.
Yeah. And I feel like a character that uses a pike believes in justice, because otherwise they'd just use a better weapon and have more of an advantage.
No, but I like the idea that he's tied to his roots, mm-hmm. right? This character has not grown too big for his britches kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, one thing I really like about 5th Edition is, you know, we'll say, ha ha, it's not a very good weapon, but...
It's fine.
Yeah, it's perfectly fine.
It's fine.
In the grand scheme of things, like, by the time you're level 8, the base damage of your weapon is not going to matter.
Right, right.
So even those 1d4, like, half attacks, they're fine.
Yep. All right. If you want to support the show, the easiest way to do that is to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And if you're willing to help us out, we'll read your 5-star review on the air.
You can also find us on Stitcher. It's like a Pandora for podcasts. If you like or favorite us there, the algorithm will help other people find us.
So what do we have planned for our next week's episode?
We're talking about playing non-human characters.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
The Master of Many Forms.
Well, that's it for episode 28 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.